at $1 trillion globally in 2023. The upcoming Global Anti-Scam Summit in Arlington will bring experts together to develop strategies to combat the threat. As scams continue to surge, inflicting financial and emotional harm, George Abraham with the Global Anti-Scam Alliance says there is an urgent need to work together.
Now the big challenge is that we have to work across the different industries and across borders, because scammers are getting very, very professionalized, and we see scammers usually doing the same scam in 80 different countries, and there the challenge is really putting them behind bars.
The summit is November 12th and 13th. Abraham advises consumers to consult friends and family before acting on suspicious texts or emails. According to the FBI, scams targeting Americans age 60 and older led to over $3.4 billion in losses in 2023, though many cases go unreported. Additionally, the FBI warns the public about scammers exploiting the 2024 U.S. general election for financial fraud. Abraham says scams are becoming the one and two most reported crimes.
We are continuously being bombarded by scammers who are trying to get our identity or our money. And the goal of the summit is to discuss how can we reduce the approaches by scammers, trying to make sure that they are less successful, and in the end, actually trying to really catch the scammers.
The FBI's report found tech support scams to be the most commonly reported type of elder fraud in 2023, affecting nearly 18,000 victims over 60. Investment scams, however, were the most financially damaging, resulting in over $1.2 billion in losses. The FBI says these often involve cryptocurrency schemes that target older Americans' finances. This is Tramell Gomes for Virginia News Connection.
Genetic studies have a diversity problem, as 95% of participants are from Northwest European ancestry. Researchers at the University of Maryland in Baltimore County are looking to change that by creating a Genetics of Latin American Diversity database and making it available to other scientists. Simone Perez has more on this story.
Genetic studies overwhelmingly are based on data from people of European descent, but University of Maryland Baltimore scientists are working to change that. Researchers have developed the Genetics of Latin American Diversity Database, pulling information from more than 200 genetic studies on almost 54,000 people of Hispanic and Latin descent. Timothy O'Connor, with the University of Maryland at Baltimore's Institute for Genome Sciences, says the diversity is important because 95% of participants in genetic studies come from Northwestern Europe.
What ends up happening as a result of that is we have a restricted view of genetic variation that we see in the world. Because of that, we miss out on genetic variation that might be causing a disease in one population, but not in another population.
Even though Latino representation makes up less than 1% of genetic data, O'Connor adds the number of people in data sets is exploding. He says that made it possible to gather so much genetic data on this population. The University of Maryland database should save other researchers time and money they'd be using to collect this information on their own. O'Connor believes the creation of this database moves past large categorizations and ancestry that are largely based on race.
What this allows us to do is to say, no, these are distant cousins. These are people that are closely related at a much more fine scale. It moves us from this thinking about groups as kind of separate into starting to think about everybody as kind of a continuous ancestry.
The Census Bureau says that more than 19% of Americans identify as Latino, including more than 12% of Marylanders. I'm Simone Perez, Maryland News Connection.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 4th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ron Bronson, Barbara Bernstein, Annette Newell, and Eliza Yurkov. The producer is Eliza Yurkov, and our engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Catherine Carley, Mark Moran, Frida Ross, Simone Perez, Eric Tegadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Nadia Romlagan, and Tremel Gomes. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eliza Yurkov.
And I'm Ron Bronson. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by members like you. If you would like to become a member and support our programs, you can do so by going to our website at kboo.fm/give or text us at KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm here with Diana McLean Smith, author of the new book, Remaking the Space Between Us, How Citizens Can Work Together to Build a Better Future for All. Welcome, Diana.
Well, thanks so much. It's great to be here with people from Portland, Oregon.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
Absolutely.
I'm excited to speak about this new book with you. Where did the idea come from? Where did you start out with this?
Well, in some ways, it was the culmination of a long career working in organizations with intergroup conflict and trying to figure out how I could convert the conflict into a productive force for change. And during the pandemic and the first Trump administration, hopefully the last, sorry to offend your viewers, it was clear to me that the same kinds of things I was seeing in organizations was happening in our nation. And it worried me deeply. And so I wanted to see what was going on, how did we get here, and is there anybody doing anything about it?
Well, like you mentioned, it's probably not news to most folks that we are politically divided and increasingly entrenched in those divides. This is one of the things you explore in the book. How did we get here?
Well, I think people like to think that it's a relatively new phenomena, but we are a country that has had conflict, intense conflict, throughout the course of our history. And we were founded, in fact, with a conflict between us and the king in Britain. And we had a revolutionary war in order to break free. And we had a Declaration of Independence, which declared all people equal and gave them the right to liberty and the pursuit of happiness. And then that got called into question with slavery. And then we fought a civil war to put that to rest. And then we had the Jim Crow period, the late 1800s, which was marked by a lot of violence. And then we had the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement in the middle of the last century. That was marked by a lot of intense conflict. So we've had a history of division throughout our nation's history. But in the last 50 years, something new has happened. And that is, there are a lot of problems around the world that are starting to cross boundaries and reach our shores, and it's making people very nervous. People are on the move in terms of immigration, pandemics are crossing boundaries, climate change is crossing boundaries, terrorism is crossing boundaries. And when that happens, people tend to cling to people who are like them, and they tend to get distant and fearful of people who are not like them. Now, that's always been a tendency we've had as a species, but in times of anxiety and uncertainty, with the trends I've just mentioned, which have become quite pronounced over the past 50 years, it becomes quite dramatic, and people really get quite insular within their own groups and quite hostile and fearful of people who are different from themselves. And that is what we are now finding ourselves having to deal with.
Like you mentioned, some of the divisions are structural, but in your book, you write that there are a lot of examples of people doing bridge building work, and it is something that individuals can take on, even when we're talking about these big structures that are beyond our control. Talk about that part of it.
Well, you know, one of the things that I was really taken by is the number of people that I discovered who were, you know, more in common talks of them as the exhausted majority, the 67% of us who are not polarized, who are not extreme. And, you know, the press has to sell papers, and so they lead with what bleeds, and they emphasize that. But there's a large swath of people who are much more flexible politically, and much more open-minded and problem-oriented, meaning they want to solve problems. And that's a very large group of people. And when I started doing the research for the book, I discovered that there were not just hundreds, not just thousands, but tens of thousands of people. Really, now I've discovered it's like millions of people across the country working in locally rooted groups that are connected nationally on problems they can solve in their communities, and through solving those problems, begin to make progress across divides. So these are groups that work across partisan divides, across demographic divides, on problems they care about together. And they start to get to know each other, and the divides start to evaporate.
Part three of your book is called Remaking Our Democracy in a New Image. And there are some structural democratic reforms that can decrease division. One of them you point to is ranked choice voting, which is actually on the state ballot in Oregon right now. What is the significance of that?
I have a lot of respect for people like Lee Drutman, who's one of the people who has in the past advocated ranked choice voting, and it is a great innovation. There are other ones that are now being put forth that may have more legs. I'm not going to go into those, because one of the things that I said in the book, which I think is really important to say here, is we can't elect candidates or make electoral reforms until we, the people, get our act together, because we're the ones driving the dysfunction. We're the ones who are supporting extremists. We're the ones who are fighting these electoral reforms. So we have to get ourselves together first. That, to me, that is what people, I don't think, like to hear, because they'd like to think that there's some magic wand. If we just have this electoral reform, it's all going to go away. I think we have to start talking to our neighbors. I think we have to take a Republican out to tea or a Democrat out to tea and get to know them. We have to reach across demographic divides. We have to stop trying to make a case, but start making relationships across these divides so that we can understand that we have common fears, common concerns, common goals. And the question always is, how are we going to meet them in a way that doesn't just serve one group, but takes into account the interests of all groups? Because like it or not, we are now a multi-group democracy, and we have some pretty serious problems to solve, and we can't do it if we're not going to work across groups. So I think the biggest electoral reform is reforming we the people.
You mentioned something that I wanted to get into. There was a quote that struck me. You write, "Friendship is the great equalizer," and the power of friendship in doing this kind of work. Can you speak to that point a bit?
When I talked about the conflicts throughout our history as a nation, I think one of the reasons that's so true is that we imagined ourselves early on not just as a democracy, but as an adversarial democracy, one where we had two parties who fought with each other in the court system. You have a prosecutor and you have the defense. We have this binary either-or, win-lose model of democracy, which is really built on our evolutionary heritage from a time many millennia ago when we learned to live within groups in order to be able to survive. We form groups. And one thing we don't pay attention to, but I think very important, is that we learned to cooperate within groups so we could compete better against other groups. And that made sense for a long time. But now we're in a world, as I said before, where the problems we're facing, they cross groups, and groups have to cooperate with each other in order to solve the problems. You can't solve things like climate change and immigration, terrorism. These are problems that must be solved by groups getting together and cooperating across groups. So one of the things I'm proposing is that when you have an adversarial democracy, you're thinking always about advancing your own interests. If you imagine your fellow citizen as a friend, which I think, you know, many of us do much of the time when we're not in the political world, so it's not that big a leap, but if you imagine your fellow citizens as a friend, then you care about their interests, not just your own. So if you don't, you're not going to have the friendship for long, right? So we have to start thinking about not just satisfying our own interests, but how do we address the interests of others? Because for us to survive as a multi-group democracy, we're going to need to do that. Otherwise, we're going to be at this 50-50 stalemate, and we're not going to be able to solve any problems, and we all go down. We all lose.
And friendship is an important component of combating the, you know, the loneliness epidemic that a lot is made of in the press.
Yes, and the loneliness epidemic is the, I think, the kindling with which we now have such hot conflicts, because people are so alone and feel so isolated that they're desperate for a sense of belonging. And I think we all have a role to play and a responsibility in our communities to make sure that everybody has a sense of belonging and a purpose and a role and some meaning. Because if they can't find it in their community, they're going to find it in these dark holes on the internet. People like to think that we can control the internet. We can't. But what we can do is shape our community so that we create the motivation for people to turn to the internet to find the belonging they're not finding in their communities.
In writing this book and talking about this subject, have you encountered any common misconceptions?
I think the biggest misconception that worries me is that we, the people, don't have the power to make a difference, and that we have to cede the ground to the extremists because they're covered so, you know, 24/7 by the press and social media. So I think the biggest misconception is this notion that the people are powerless. We have a huge amount of power, but it isn't just as individuals. And most importantly, like one of the things I tried to drive home in the book, and there are plenty of stories there, is that there really are hundreds of organizations, from Starts With Us to Listen First Project to Urban Rural Action to Not in Our Town. I mean, there are just countless organizations out there that are mobilizing people across divides to work on these common problems. And if we can really lean into that ourselves and join these groups, support these groups, then we have endless power to turn around what I know is driving all of us crazy, which is this endless animosity. It is totally within our control. It is our inability to imagine that. And then to, you know, I mean, my book is just one of many, many resources that people could find to figure out ways that they themselves can become part of the solution and stop becoming part of the problem.
Well, you and I are speaking the day before Election Day. Do you have any advice for folks going into this election and maybe the week or so after, regardless or with either winner that we might see?
Well, it's a really, really important question, and I think about it all the time. You know, I have my own political views, and I know I have good friends who are Trump supporters, by the way. So, and I'm not a Trump supporter. But we all are going to have different views, and we're going to vote differently. I think we're putting too much weight on the election. We have a big job in front of us, and the job is not winning an election. It's a long game. We have to rebuild our democracy as a multi-group democracy. That's not going away. It's just a fact that we have multiple groups living in our country, and we're going to have to find a way to cooperate together so we can solve problems that we have in common. We all have in common the effects of climate change, the effects of immigration, the effects of economic dislocation, which has dislocated many, many communities across the nation. We all have an interest in solving those problems, even if we disagree on how to do it. We need to start talking with each other about it directly and not retreating to our own separate groups and denigrating one another. I think what we ought to be looking at is the long game of how we rebuild our democracy over the next 5 to 10 years, regardless of who's in office. We have a role to play as people, not just as voters, in our interactions with each other in our neighborhoods every day.
If our listeners are interested in finding more out about you or about your book, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, the book is Remaking the Space Between Us, and it can be found on Amazon. I also have a website that has a lot of resources, which I highly recommend for people who want to figure out how they can become part of the solution. That's called remakingthespace.org, and there's a section in there on resources where people can get hooked up with different organizations. And these, again, they're in Portland, they're all through Oregon. I mean, there are lots of opportunities for your listeners to get involved. And so I would recommend those two sources. The other thing I want to say is not having to do with my book, but there's an organization called Starts With Us, has a website and has exercises for people. Another one is Good Conflict. These are organizations that can really help you figure out how you can interact with people who have different backgrounds, different views, different political affinities more productively going forward.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
My only final thought is that, you know, it's so tough. I mean, I feel it myself, what we've been going through as a nation. It's so dispiriting in many ways, given how especially how the press covers it. You'd think there was absolutely no hope. It's just not true. There's a huge number of people out there doing wonderful things. And my biggest worry is that people are going to give up on we're going to give up on ourselves as a people, and we're going to give up on each other. And I think we can't afford to do it, and we don't need to do it. There's lots happening. It just will take a little bit of initiative, and I mean a little bit of initiative, to find out where and who and how to plug in. But we can't afford for that to happen. If that happens, then it's all over. And I really think that would be a shame.
Well, Diana, thank you so much for talking about your book with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show. I so appreciate it.
That was Diana McLean Smith, author of the new book, Remaking the Space Between Us, How Citizens Can Work Together to Build a Better Future for All. You've been listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Ron Bronson. We're joined today by Harmony Dashiell and Lily Burnett from the Yes Campaign for the Park Rose Teachers Levy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
We're super excited to have you talk to us today about this levy. So talk to us a bit about Measure 26245. What is it, and what would it do if voters pass it?
So it's the Park Rose Teachers Levy, and we're calling it that because it will fund only teaching positions. And our school district, which is a teeny tiny district next to Portland Public, we've got about 2,800 kids total. And we are facing a $3.5 million budget shortfall in the next school year if we don't pass this levy. So we're asking folks to vote yes so that we can maintain our current classroom sizes and extracurriculars.
If I'm understanding, this isn't the first time this levy's been on the ballot, right?
No. It's not. Two years ago, we tried to pass it, and it did not pass.
By less than 400 votes, am I right?
So close, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that really illustrates the need for people to really get on their horses and, you know, well, and luckily you don't have to go to the ballot box. We all know this. Just open your ballot box and get your pencil out.
Mm-hmm. 100%, right? Yes.
Absolutely. So talk to us a little bit about what this would mean for the district. Talk about a big deficit, but like, what does that mean tangibly for students, for teachers?
Yeah, 100%. So we only have 6 schools, as Lily was saying. We're a small school district, but this measure would mean 28 different teaching positions. So when you look at percentage-wise, that's 15% of our teaching staff. That's definitely measurable. That's tangible. We feel that if it passes. We definitely feel it if it doesn't pass. And so what does that mean for our youth, our kids, our community? That's really a game changer in the resources and the individual attention that we can give to our youth.
That's really, 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 really a salient point. But I guess so, like, people, you know, wonder about the pocketbook. Everybody's struggling right now. Things are really hard. Yeah. But what's the impact on property owners with something like this and levy like this?
Yeah. So this is a $1.25 tax per $1,000 worth of property tax that you have. It's looking at about $26 a month per the average household, or just over $300 a year. That's not insignificant, especially in our community. Like you said, we're all feeling it in the pocketbook. Costs for everything have raised. Mm-hmm. And for me, the counter to that is, what is the cost if we don't do this? And so is it worth it? For me, no brainer. Like, losing 28 teaching positions, I got to pay the 26 and figure it out, because who else is going to come through for our kids?
28 teaching positions. I just really illustrate 28. You know, some schools have 28 teachers in them, the entire school. And we're talking about 28 positions that's funded from this thing that if we get together, you know, one of the things that I know I found, I was struck by moving to Oregon. I'm in Oregon about 7 years, but moving here is how goofy we fund schools. Like, what a wacky system.
Yes.
You know, if we were starting from scratch today, there's no way anybody would agree to this. It's one thing that, you know, whether you're in a rural district or you're Eastern Oregon, or if you're over here in the city, you know, outside of Portland, like, we all agree that this is a really goofy way, a really terrible way, frankly. We're cheating our kids and our communities mm-hmm. in the way that we fund schools, right? And so the state funding only covers the bare minimum. Am I right about that?
That's right.
I would say not even
the bare minimum. Yes. Right, right. So that's an issue where people ask, well, you know, where is my or my other taxes coming from? The state's not covering their fair share of this because of laws that are, you know, passed many before many of us were born in some cases or well after. Mm-hmm. And we haven't fixed these kinds of things. But so we talked about this being on a ballot before, but, you know, talking to folks about this issue in you know, I think it's really clear for us about, you know, coming out of the COVID era and students being mm-hmm. locked in their houses, and we're seeing this mental health issues with students and things like that, mm-hmm. that having teachers on board, having programs in our schools really can support, you know, teachers to support the programs that are in our schools mm-hmm. can really help those students. But what are some of the misconceptions you've heard about, you know, this levy and you know, again, we missed by 400 votes last time. What are the kind of things you're hearing from folks that we can help clear up tonight, maybe?
Yeah, I think last time a big thing that we heard was that people just weren't even aware that there was a levy on the ballot. You know, it was midterm elections. There was a lot going on. People were still very much distracted by COVID, understandably so. It was 2022. And this time around, we are definitely trying to make sure that that is not anybody's excuse for not voting on the levy. Because not only did we have more no votes than yes, but we had a lot of undervotes.
Of course.
People who had filled out other parts of their ballot but left the levy unanswered, which is a vote. It's, you know, what we call a protest vote. Right. But who's protesting the teacher's levy?
Right.
The other thing I want to spell out for folks is that the school district was facing budget shortfalls before the pandemic, and our schools didn't have PE in the elementary schools.
Wow.
We didn't have sports at the middle school. We didn't have counselors in every school. And then what COVID did was it actually brought a boost of federal funding that allowed us over the last 3 years to build in where now all of our elementary school students, all the way down to preschool, do have access to PE.
Wow.
And we have middle school sports. It's taken 3 years to build up and add to. We're able to offer middle school band. We have counselors in every school now. And those are all the types of things that are going to be the first thing to go if this doesn't pass. Because we can't have 28 teachers who are teaching, you know, state-required curriculum. We can't cut that. Or we couldn't operate as a school district. So it's going to be things like after-school sports and counselors in the schools. If the kids aren't moving and they aren't supported, how can we get mad at them for having high absenteeism rates? Like, it's punishing the kids.
Anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think one thing that we hear sometimes is from folks who don't have kids and live in the community, mm-hmm. and it's not just a tax on those of us who have kids that are attending in the school district. And yes, I hear that. We hear that. And also, one thing that I love about Park Rose is how tight-knit of a community it is. It's not even just a sense of community. It is a community. We mm-hmm. celebrate together. We work together. We live together. All of these things are happening. And yes, you might not have kids in the school district because they've aged out. You moved in after you didn't have kids. But it's still all of us. It still impacts our families. It impacts your neighbors. It impacts our youth. And one thing that we can really do is tap on that. Lean back on that sense of community, on that reality of community that we have, and say, the state can't fix this by next school year.
Right.
Nobody's
right.
going to come through and wave a magic wand. There's no real backup plan if this doesn't go through. So this is our opportunity to come through for our community's kids and say, we've got you. You know, we'll work on the other stuff in the next 5 years. Hopefully there's a lot of work going on in the legislation and the governor's mm-hmm. office because of all the things that you mentioned earlier about our broken system. But at this moment in time, our community can come through for our community. And that's what we got.
I really love that you mentioned the community part of this, because I think that that's often lost in people. We talk about kids in schools these days. And what's funny is if you had a time machine, let's not do that. But if you had a time machine, you could go back to the 50s or something. Nobody would gripe at the idea that you'd fund your local school. Why wouldn't you, right? Because you need to take care of the kids, right? But all of a sudden these days, these are problems that we have with this. And it's really funny. Not funny, it's terrible. It's sad that this is a thing. So I really appreciate you bringing that up. As we kind of wrap up here, thinking a little bit about this, really appreciate you all coming on today. Are there any final thoughts, anything you want to add to this, this really important measure? Hopefully people really hear this today. Not only hear it, but tell people, talk to people who are able, you know, on those ballots, don't leave that ballot blank. Make sure that, you know, you check yes when you're filling out that ballot. I know you're filling it out this year. It's really important election to do that. But anything, any final thoughts you want to add, either of you?
Yeah, I think make sure you go all the way to the end of the ballot. This is the very last ballot measure. And so you got to flip it over. It's two sides. That's step one. And then it's you got to go all the way to the end. And I know there is a lot to think about this election season. But that is the one thing that we're really asking is don't quit on us. Get all the way to that last question.
The only other thing I'll add is that, you know, for Park Rose, like we're at a turning point right now where we either decide that together we're going to invest in our schools and they're going to get better, or we're not. And it's really pulling the carpet out from underneath the kids. And we have the most racially diverse public high school in Oregon. And that's who you're pulling the rug out from.
Right. Right. It's such an important, really important part. And really super appreciate you all coming on the show today and talking to us about the Park Rose Teachers Levy. I've been joined by Harmony Dashiel and Lily Burnett from the Yes on Measure 26245 campaign. That's the Park Rose Teachers Levy. This is the KBOO News in Depth. I'm Ron Bronson. We've got more coming your way in just a moment.
This is KBOO Portland, volunteer-powered community radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification.